Hi there, let's play a game. I'm going to describe to you a nation of the world, and your aim is to try to guess where on earth in creation I'm talking about. So this is the kind of place you'd see some Christmas charity appeal to ask for money in order to help the poor souls who live there. It's highly politically unstable. Governments seem to fall every few years, and this political instability has been driven by endless small bushfire civil wars, which are eternally fueled by small militias led by warlords who continuously wage war upon one another, it seems over some political slight, or mostly in revenge for previous attacks upon them. The country is terribly poor. Everywhere you look, you see people desperately trying to make their farms work. Almost the entire population lived in small rural communities where every few years the crops would fail and famine would arrive. The worst hit regions are then frequently filled with images of starving children, their bellies distended, flies circling their tear-rimmed eyes. Healthcare is non-existent. Half of all babies die before they reach the age of 10. It is a place of extreme mind-numbing poverty, except for the richer oligarchs of the society. These people live in opulence, and the contrasting standards of living between them and the poor is really jarring to see. There is so much potential here. Those who have not fallen into total abject poverty are desperate to prevent themselves doing so and are enterprising, aspirational, driven by fear. If allowed, they could drive this nation upwards and forward. And as such, the citizens would like strong law and order. They're willing to forego loss of liberties for stability, and they would support any strong man who can give them peace. They are deeply religious, their faith driving them and uniting them as a coherent whole. So if circumstances allowed, these people could and would improve their condition. Yet with this being said, overall, this entire place is unhealthy, unstable, unsanitary, and underdeveloped. And its people, their nature, and very characters have been entirely dictated by these terrible circumstances. I am, of course, talking about England in the 1490s. And indeed, while Henry VII was new on the throne and would in fact give these people what they wanted, his reign was too new and the changes had not yet begun. Which brings us to the question that this chapter will attempt to answer. What was the mentality of the people Henry VII now ruled? The biggest issue with any kind of writing about the past is trying to allow others visualize in their minds what it was like. Lavish TV productions can make versions to place on the screen, but hopefully they will consult with historians to be accurate in how people dressed and what they ate and so forth. This gives you a visual fix, at least. But words are needed to illustrate a world for us, so we can imagine what it was like to be there. But the hardest task is to find out what people in the past thought like. See, the long-running theme of this story of London has been that people are people. Biologically, physically, and neurologically, we humans have not changed in tens of thousands of years. We crave food, heat, dryness, love. Our amazing bodies fight diseases and infection then as now the same. We respond to undercooked food the same as our ancient ancestors, in usually explosive diarrheal ways. We sleep and we dream. We cry and we laugh. Humans are humans. Psychologically, however, things differ. We conceptualize things now differently than we did in the past. Many of the great passions we hold as self-evidential truths of who we are, definitions of our character, to those in the past would have been alien concepts that never once crossed their wildest imaginations. The past is not our country with the time changed. The past is a different country and a different culture. And even if we could speak the same language as those people, we would find them alien and foreign to us and our sensibilities. As such, trying to grasp how people thought is never easy. Not that we haven't tried, even on this podcast. Several times in the story of London, I've tried to stop and look at the changing nature of the mindsets of people of the city in the past. Back in chapter 10, I tried to work out how the earliest residents of Lüdenwick coped with the Viking raids. In chapter 21, we met the birth of the ferociously faithful Anglo-Saxon population. In chapter 58, we had a short ephemeris that tried to get under the skin of those living in the city in the 12th century. But now here we are in the 15th century and it's time to stop and look around. At the country, but mostly at the city and its people. Who were these residents? How did they think? What is it about these people that within a generation or so they were to witness and cause the most profound changes in the city and the nation's character? Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the detailed history of London as one long chronologically driven story. And over the past 3 years, we have followed the city through time. And we are at the very start of the reign of Henry VII. And here we pause our forward momentum just for a little to ground ourselves and to try to peer into the mindsets of the residents of the city as the Tudor age begins, if only to give us a baseline from which to witness how profound the changes that are coming are going to be. Welcome then to chapter 177 of this story of London, Doth Comfort the Heavy and Troubled Mind. So let's begin with London, the biggest city in England in the 1490s by a huge margin. Please get rid of the idea of ye olde medieval society. As I described earlier, see this city as part of a nation that is underdeveloped. Yet let's use modern terms to help you visualise things. An underdeveloped nation like many we see on the news today. You know the type, no industry, chronic political instability, entirely rural, starving kids. If you were to travel back in time, this would be the kind of place you'd be going to. The population of the country is small, pitifully small compared to today. Now, while exact figures are hard to come by, around about the year 1500, so about 10 years from now, we estimate the population was between 2 and 3 million people across the whole of England. 200 years later, by 1700, it had risen to about 5 million. So here we are at the start of the 1490s, and we're right at the beginning of a period of immense population growth. The overwhelming majority of people of the time are engaged in the production of food. As much as 80% of the entire population lived in villages and hamlets. Urban regions were incredibly small. A handful of towns, places like Bristol, York, Exeter, Norwich. In this land, nowhere is a large conurbation with one exception. London. London was growing in the 1480s into the 1490s. It had started growing before and continued to grow all the way through the era to come. A wild, exponential growth out of kilter with anywhere else in the land. And some historians have suggested that based on the population fluctuations, that it could only have worked if as much as 1/6 of the entire population of England spent at least a part of their lives in the city. And indeed, coming to London for some years before returning to your rural towns and villages and, you know, bringing London tastes and fashions back with you was something we're going to observe again and again through this era. So why did the city during the Tudor era start drawing people to it so? Well, to answer that, we need to back up a little. So hang on to that question. The nation these people lived in was incredibly stratified, with really brutal contrasts between the rich and the poor. A third to a half of the entire population lived at subsistence level. They were chronically underemployed. And these people were the, quote, cottagers, paupers, labouring people and outservants, unquote, who made up the bulk of the population. Many of them were tenant farmers occupying small tenements, and many more were simple wage labourers. Crucially, very few are what we would call peasants. The medieval image of generational indenture, or ye olde peasant folk, was already fading away by this time. The sheer numbers of people culled by the Black Death, which had caused massive social disruption as the population had been devastated, and the old ways of ensuring that a stable rural workforce had been destroyed because of them. Sure, back then, Edward III had introduced the draconian statute of labourers, the law which said everyone will act the same way and do the same job for exactly the same money as they did before the plague killed everybody else. It was brutal in its enforcement, but in reality it was a law that was pissing into the hurricane of inevitability. The long-term decline of the English peasantry was already underway. And thus you had now, in the 1490s, this base low level of cottagers, paupers, labouring people and outservants, a somewhat itinerant, untethered body of citizens forever dependent upon seasonal work, and that seasonal work depended on the smooth flowing of the seasons. This was the largest group of people in the country out there right now. Now, above them was the second largest group of people in England, who were the more prosperous class of farmers, freeholders and tradesmen. These people were driven. They could see the conditions of those worse off than them, and out of sheer terror of dropping down to being that poor, they were driven perhaps by fear as much as the desire to emulate those better off, to become aspirational. This aspirational class was an engine that steered them to improve their condition and those of their children, and this aspiration was infectious. Part of the poorer classes below would come to emulate it, and this vast engine of desire was to end up driving much of the social change that's going to come. See, at the very top of this society were the traditional elite of the landed gentry, and above them, of course, the nobility of England. Yet again, this medieval model of such things was being challenged in this era already. London was now driving the growth of new emergence into this top strata of society. The rising professional groups like lawyers and legalists, senior clergymen, professional civil servants and government officials, and above all, entrepreneurial merchants. They were joining gentry and the nobility as the clear haves in a society mostly driven by have-nots. One historian estimated that this top strata of society, while making up only 5% of the national population, probably controlled over 50% of the wealth, which is more than everybody else put together. The social elite was highly educated, but a change in the desires of that aspirational class was beginning, albeit slowly, to produce an amazing growth over the next few decades, which would then snowball. I mean, it's calculated that within 200 years of our start date in the 1490s, there would be a grammar school in England for every 4,500 people, and that we would actually see a full 2.5% of the relevant age group of the entire male population actually be receiving some form of higher education at either Oxford, Cambridge, or London's Inns of Court. I mean, this is incredible. That last fact was a level of higher education not matched until the 20th century. We were about to enter an era of immense creative activity in various fields, including prose, poetry, drama, architecture, theology, mathematics, physics, chemistry, history, cryptography, and many other fields. However, simultaneously alongside this, with a large and yet unknown proportion of the population, perhaps between a half and two-thirds of all adult males, who were unable to read and could only sign their name with a mark. This significant variation in standards of living, in educational expectations and social aspirations, makes this society so diverse and therefore so difficult to generalise about. Conditions are going to change over the next two centuries as well, and at every given point there were many numerous layers of belief and levels of sophistication, not helped by the explosion of printed word. In other words, this is not a simple, unified, primitive world with a monoculture, but a dynamic and infinitely varied society where social and intellectual change had long been at work, with currents moving in many different directions. And let's consider that these kind of changes didn't just start with Henry VII taking the throne. The huge avalanche of change had been initiated during the latter part of the previous era, in the political instability of the fall of the Plantagenets. So why did so many move to London, even briefly, during this age to come? Because it was uniquely placed to be a place where that change was being driven forward. It was again to become a kingdom unto itself, almost a state within a state, who began to offer opportunity for those who were able to grasp it. It was to become a fulcrum in the changes to come. So knowing that is coming, how then do we begin to grasp the mind state of people in the early Tudor period who still had one foot in that medieval era? Don't we need to find something that all classes of society in London and the surrounding nation could agree upon? We need to find a common ground that we can unite this diverse and disparate bunch of people. A universal constant, something that the people of this era shared with their medieval forebears, but would also share with us. A bedrock upon which we can build and translate this complex time into concepts we in this era can visualise and imagine. And in that we have one prime candidate. While it had and has today many variations, there is one universal theme of human thought that was constant then, was constant in their past, and is constant now in their future. And that is, how do people respond and cope with misfortune? How do you deal with the bad things in life happening to you? This is how we try to approach understanding the Mercian residents of Ludenwick all the way back in chapter 10. This is a concept we understand. In our modern society, where we talk so easily of trauma and anxiety, opening up to the intricacies and difficulties of life itself comes naturally. We spend a lot of time dealing with life's challenges and as such. By looking at how people dealt with the same back then, we get some insight into the differences between us and them. With me still? I hope so. So if we take this as our baseline, then let us state the bleeding obvious, shall we? The mindset of the early Tudor residents of London was driven by their reality of coping with the many hazards of an intensely insecure environment. Many of their beliefs about this had been inherited from earlier generations, and therefore predated the society they found themselves living in, but certain features of this and the next century could hardly fail to influence them. One of these features was the expectation of life itself. Because right now, I think it's beyond dispute that a person living in London at the dawn of the Tudor era were, by our standards, extremely susceptible to pain, sickness, and a premature death. And I'm not exaggerating. Even amongst the nobility, whose chances at life were likely to have been better than those of all the other classes, the life expectancy at the birth of a boy born in 1490 was only 29 and a half years. Now today it'd be around 70. But the truth was, a third of those aristocratic infants died before the age of 5. And that level of mortality is shocking, rarely seen in this modern era. I mean, even today, nations we see having exceptionally high child mortality rates, such as Afghanistan, Chad, or Somalia, those hover about 1 in 10 deaths before the age of 5. And we find that horrific. Now compare that to the Tudor era's 1 in 3. And conditions in London, however, were actually worse than the national average of this time. The first English demographer, John Grant, estimated that of every 100 children born in London in this era, 36 died in their first 6 years, and a further 24 in the following 10 years. That's 50% of all children born in London in this era would die before they are 16. So we're talking of an age where when you had a baby, flip a coin to see if it would make it to adulthood. And this, as I've explained in previous episodes, is the reason why life expectancy was said to be so short. It's an average. It wasn't that a 30-year-old rich kid would suddenly go, oh my God, I've turned 30, that's it, I'm old. It's just that we base life expectancy figures on the average age of the dead folks in any given country. And if half the frickin' kids are dying before the age of 16, then the average age of life expectancy is gonna drop like a brick from a window. The situation would improve over the next coming years. By the mid-16th century, the expectation of birth may have been your life expectancy was 40 or 45, for country folk anyway. But for the people living at this time, they didn't need any elaborate demographic investigations to tell them that life was short, or that the odds were against any individual living out his full span. One writer, writing in 1635, so quite a bit of time ahead of us, wrote, quote, "We shall find more who have died within 30 or 35 years of age than past it," unquote. And even those who survived the elevated chances of death that childhood brought with it, this being the age before vaccination, the great saviour of children in our world today, even they at best could anticipate a lifetime ahead of intermediate physical pain. Literary sources suggest that many persons suffered chronically from some ailment or another. And this impression is confirmed by looking at what we know of their diets. The food supply was always precarious, and throughout this period, the fate of the annual harvest remained crucial. Now, the rather meagre evidence we do have suggests that the yield ratio on seed corn was possibly something that doubled between the years 1500 and 1660, which meant that towards the end of that era, there was twice as much food being grown on the same land than there was at the start of the era. But as we've already said, during that same time, the national population also doubled. So there was always just enough food to feed England. And just enough doesn't always cut it. About one harvest in six seems to have been a total failure, and mortality would rise when that happened. This is an era where it was rare, but certainly not unknown, for men to simply die in the streets from starvation. Even at times of plenty, most people seem to have suffered from a chronic lack of vitamin A, aka green vegetables and butter, and vitamin D, aka eggs and milk. The lack of vitamin A probably accounts for the numerous complaints we see of sore eyes, what we would today call cases of xerophthalmia, while the lack of vitamin D caused widespread cases of rickets. We also had cases related to diseases that were variations of scurvy taking place. They were quite common at the time. And the well-known at the time green sickness, which seemed to attack young and adolescent women, which many contemporaries thought was some kind of sexual thing, was actually chalorosis, the invariant of anemia produced by a lack of iron in the desert. And that actually would affect richer girls because the upper class actually liked to disdain from eating fresh vegetables, and it manifested itself in fatigue, extreme pallor, and a greenish tint to the skin. The well-to-do of England at this time tended to eat too much meat, and as well as the side effects from that, were also frequently constipated because of it. They did not regard milk as a drink for adults, you see, and they frequently suffered from urinary tract infections. Now, the lower classes' dietary deficiencies were not so much driven by ignorance, more by simple poverty. I mean, it wasn't until several hundred years in the future that labourers in this country had enough meat and butter to live healthily. In the 1490s, they may have had better teeth from eating more vegetables than their rich counterparts, but they were chronically undernourished and vulnerable to tuberculosis and gastric upsets caused by bad foods, which were known at the time as griping in the guts. And if that wasn't enough, rich and poor alike were victims of the infections generated by a lack of hygiene and ignorance of antiseptics and an absence of effective sanitation. Epidemics accounted for many deaths, and as we saw with the sweating sickness we mentioned last episode, they came in many forms. And just like we see now in the winter of 2025, influenza was a persistent killer, but it was not the most feared of the diseases of this time. That title was held by bubonic and pneumonic plague, which remained endemic until the last quarter of the 17th century. It was a disease of towns, and it particularly affected built-up areas in those towns with the poor, lived in crowded, filthy conditions, thus attracting black rats, which carried the fleas which spread the disease, as we covered in a very detailed way back in chapter 122. Between now, at the start of the 1490s, and the great final visitation of the plague in 1665, there were only a dozen years when London was free from it. Some people thought to have died of it every single year, and periodically it would just erupt into massive outbreaks. So the first change between then and now was, simply put, back then people's expectation was to face a life filled with aches, pains, maladies and chronic conditions far more than we do. I mean, there was at a time an organised medical profession, but it had very little to offer people. Most university-educated physicians were given a purely academic training in the principles of humoral physiology. In other words, they studied the great works of Hippocrates, Aristotle, Galen. They were being taught that illness sprung from an imbalance between the four humours of the human body: phlegm, yellow bile, blood and black bile. And your diagnosis was basically establishing which of these humours was out of line, and your treatment was taking steps to restore the balance, either by cutting the patient open or applying leeches to allow the humorally imbalanced blood to flow away, or by subjecting the patient to a course of purges and emetics. The physician thus followed the awful round of bloodletting and purging with a prescription of plasters, ointments and potions. On the whole, physicians at the time focused on the symptoms of any given disease, be it pain, fever or dysentery, rather than the disease itself. The patient's urine was taken to be the best guide to his condition, and there were some practitioners who even thought they didn't need to see a patient. All they needed to do was to smell and taste the urine and they could tell you what was wrong with them. Yeah. It's just as well as that, strictly following Galenic theory, at any given point, one of the humours in the human body was always thought to predominate, and so that perfect health was, by nature, unattainable. Yeah, at least expectations were low. There were no x-rays or MRI machines, there were no stethoscopes. A physician was usually ignorant of what was going on inside a sick person's body. Now, there were surgeons who dealt with what's going on inside, and they dealt with tumours and ulcers and fractures and venereal diseases, but their art was regarded as inferior to the physicians, and let's be blunt, without anaesthetics or antiseptics, there was very little they could do safely. Operations were largely confined to amputations, trepanning the skull, bone setting, and of course, age-old ritual of slicing open abscesses. Patients were understandably terrified of undergoing this kind of torture, and the mortality rate after such operations was not surprisingly high. Yet this failure of contemporary doctors to offer any kind of adequate theory for most diseases didn't actually matter very much to most of the population of London. The attentions of a qualified physician were effectively beyond their reach because there was a severe limit in the number of trained men. I mean, in 30 years from now, around about 1518, the Royal College of Physicians would be set up to supervise and license physicians practicing in the City of London and within a 7-mile radius. And when it started, it had only a dozen members, whereas London's population was perhaps 60,000. Before the end of the century, the college's membership had risen to 38, while the population more than doubled. The ratio of Londoners to their resident physicians could never be more than 5,000 to 1. Usually it was greater than that. So as we said, it mattered very little to most Londoners if there was a physician about. This is a time where medicine and medical services began at home. Everyone had a repertoire of private remedies to public ailments. In the future, in 1449, we see Nicholas Culpepper reflect on this long-lasting English tradition when he would say, quote, "All the nation are already physicians. If you ail in anything, everyone you meet, whether a man or woman, will prescribe you a medicine for it," unquote. London did have hospitals, St. Bartholomew's and St. Thomas's, for example. But these two institutions were mainly for the physically ill who were poor. Certainly nobody of any social pretension would ever enter one as a patient, and everybody who did certainly had an increased chance of contracting some fatal infection while were there. So overall, for people living in early Tudor London, the overwhelming mindset of those facing a lifetime sharing this world with the, they didn't know at the time, viruses, bacteria and infections that come with life and it's all its medical problems, was simply an overwhelming sense of helplessness. You could do nothing. It was what it was. Luck, which was a concept they didn't actually articulate at this time, was basically a part of life. You either made it or you didn't. But coping with physical ailments or sudden death were not the only issues that people had to come to terms with. Sudden misfortune was a constant faced in many other aspects of life. After physical concerns driven by the overwhelming fear of a deadly plague, say, the next biggest fear was environmental ones. Bad weather could kill you, either by exposure or a failed harvest. But other environmental issues could drastically change your life, even if you were physically unharmed. Fire was a genuine fear. This was much more of a risk in built-up areas. The towns of England were particularly vulnerable with their thatched roofs and wooden chimneys and crowded living conditions. And once a fire had broken out, it seldom encountered anything people could do with it. Firefighting techniques in Tudor England were unchanged from firefighting techniques during the Norman Conquest. London, we know, required households to keep buckets of water outside their doors just in case, and it also tried to check the erection of wooden buildings and thatched roofs. That had been the official policy of the City of London since the 12th century, as we have covered, but making such regulations are much easier to do than enforcing such regulations. And firefighting equipment proved sadly inadequate when the blaze was underway. In fact, the only effective way people knew of stopping a fire was to tear down buildings it was about to burn down so it wouldn't have anything to spread with. And then, when the fires dwindled, there was actually inevitably trouble with people stealing what remained. And this was a continuation of the most terrifying thing about fires. There was no insurance. If your wealth was in property and then along comes a fire, your wealth is gone. And it had always been this way. It had probably been the Paternoster fire back in the past which had damn near bankrupted the father of Thomas Becket. And this truth had remained all the way up to now in the 1490s. All the victim of a fire could do was apply for church relief. As a purely economic factor, therefore, fire was exceedingly important and it was terrifying. There was no symbol of an environmental issue that better summed up the instability of human fortunes. Quote, "He which at 1 o'clock was worth £5,000, and, as the prophet saith, drank his wine in bowls of fine silver plate, had not by 2 o'clock so much as a wooden dish left to eat his meat in, nor a house to cover his sorrowful head." Unquote. The sermons, said aloud in churches on Sunday, served as a constant reminder of how men could be reduced in instant from wealth to utter penury, and there was no telling whose turn it could be next. So, sudden poverty, unexpected sickness, and the suffering from other unexplained disasters were thus familiar features of the social environment of this period. But we must not make the anachronistic mistake of assuming that contemporaries then were daunted by all of this as we should be. In Tudor London, people were fully accustomed to disease and low expectation of life. Like we do, like all humans do, you normalise adversity. You come to terms with the traumatic. You learn to deal with it. And how do we see this manifested at the time? Well, when it came to child mortality, don't believe people who say otherwise, parents did feel great levels of grief at the time when they lost their children. They were not stoic or indifferent. The grief at the death of a child was universal. But we do see that the parents were perhaps slower to recognise the individuality of their children, knowing that they could, you know, drop dead any day. And husbands and wives were better adjusted to the idea of surviving their partner and marrying someone else, till death do us part, usually never meant forever. And we see this normalization of the volatile nature of life manifests itself in the poor with something one historian called, quote, careless stoicism, unquote. Observers at the time would make comment on the poorer people's insensibility in the face of dangers of, say, plague, and were shocked by the general reluctance to obey regulations designed for their own safety. It was almost as if they'd been surrounded by so many plagues and troubles that moderating their actions was never taken seriously. And all classes sought to escape reality in their own way. Drink, for example, was built into the very fabric of everybody's social life. It played a part in nearly every public and private ceremony going on. Every commercial bargain, every craft gathering, every private occasion, be it mourning or rejoicing. And at fairs and markets, which remained exempt until the 19th century from normal licensing regulations, the consumption of alcohol could be stupendous. So events like Westminster Fair, Southwark Fair, and above all, St. Bart's Fair were often incredibly drunken moments. A preacher a few decades from now, when we're talking about, would actually go on to comment, quote, "Go but to the town's end where a fair is kept, and there they lie as if some battle had been fought. Here lies one man, there another," unquote. Alcohol was the essential narcotic which anaesthetized men and women against the stress of life in the 1490s. Drunkenness, mild drunkenness, broke down social distinctions and brought a temporary mood of optimism to the desperate. The poor took drink to blot out some of the horror in their lives. And we see alcohol flowing freely at times of plague or national crisis. And indeed, those scheduled for execution in this era often tried to get as drunk as possible beforehand. Ale, wrote somebody at the time, quote, "does comfort the heavy and troubled mind. It will make a weeping widow laugh and forget the sorrow for her deceased husband. It is the warmest lining of a naked man's coat. It assuages hunger and cold. With a toast, it is the poor man's comfort. The shepherd, mower, ploughman and blacksmith's most esteemed purchase. It is the tinker's treasure, the peddler's jewel, the beggar's joy, and the prisoner's loving nurse," unquote. So as a means of making life momentarily tolerable, drink had few rivals amongst the very poor. One 15th century heretic went on to say that there was more good in a cask of ale than in the four Gospels. A further escape from reality was to be found in gambling. Men gambled on cards, dice, horse races, foot races, bear baiting, dog fighting, cock fighting, and a host of similar pastimes. They bet on virtually anything. Even very poor men engaged heavily in gambling, and the judicial records of the time maintain occasional references to labourers who were unable to support their wives and kids because they lost all their money at cards. And there was also, we see, a rise in the need to respond to the brutality of life by gambling on legality itself. Around 1490, men began to be far more likely to chance breaking the law. Need, circumstance, and aspiration were a powerful driving force. Punishments were harsh, but life was harsh. You could be dead tomorrow. If you see a chance, take it. This illegality was to become a significant factor in life. It had always been so. If you remember all the way back in chapter 17, we described how, back as far as the 10th century, London's first organisational body of any form were the ferocious lynch mobs of the Peace Guild, the sanctioned mobs of vigilantes who would chase down and kill anyone who stole from a Londoner and would also kill anyone trying to defend the said thief. Crime had always been a part of London, as the copious records we have quoted in this podcast have shown. And we'll continue to talk about crime in future chapters and don't want to dwell upon it here too much, except to say that, based on the city records, London was about to enter a similar golden age of illegality, with the nature of crime also becoming more sophisticated and interesting. Sure, no one will pull the kind of robberies that we'd seen in the past, such as the audacious great robbery of the Crown Jewels we covered back in chapters 109 and 110. But there is a lot of crime coming. But by the Tudor era then, we see crime and sin in some ways become another way people in this era were able to cope with the general hazards of life. Risk management and risk assessment in the face of such perennially difficult lives does seem to have been different from our own. And yet, paradoxically, the Tudor mindset was one who venerated law and order. For me, this was born out of the era preceding. As I stated in previous chapters, even before the War of the Roses began, the erosion of obedience towards law and above all order had led the nobility of England to simply display the same, you know what, you could die tomorrow, so why not go for it mindset we're going to see in petty criminals. And this is why they began a series of private wars which so had rocked England and given us the blood feuds and vendettas over in the West Country or up north with the massive Percy and Neville feud. And these had sown the seeds that was to become the War of the Roses and the era's seemingly endless instability. Because of this, people longed for the stability of order. And in this, one of the most powerful bedrocks for them for imposing order upon society was the church. Now, it's easy to dismiss or think we know about the all-powerful nature of religious belief at the start of the Tudor era. I mean, you know, we know this. We know coming up will be the Reformation, Henry VIII's break with Rome, the birth of the Church of England, the passions of faith that will go with that saga. And this will become a player in the foreground in the major events in the story to come. But to understand how big and important it is, we have to grasp that given everything I just described about how people viewed the fragility of life and this endless fear of misfortune or illness, one has to realise that the most crucial way people at the time coped was by faith. Faith was their solace. Faith was the core way of conceptualising this really harsh and uncaring world. It gave them hope, strength, reconciliation. It gave them purpose. It was, to the people of Tudor London, faith was their salve and their balm. The sheer importance of faith to London and the Londoners is self-evident. The large number of churches contained within its walls, the endless cacophony of bells, which was its most latent soundtrack. And while we can look at these as outward displays of this faith, the true bastion of religion in London was found in the minds of every man, every woman, and every child of the city at this time. It burned ferociously and passionately. It defined them as people in a way that would make many of us today, if we met them, really uncomfortable. Because this faith struck differently to the faith we ever see today. Not even the wild evangelical excesses of today's modern American version of Christianity, or the seemingly all-consuming obedience of strict Salafist Islam, can match the sheer power of the faith of the people of this era. You see, to them, faith and the church were synonymous. One could not and did not exist without the other. Yet there had been outliers. We'd covered the story of the Lollards back in chapters 147 and 148. But even the Lollards and the future Protestants were organisations who began life with the desire to adapt the church and therefore the faith. The two could not be separated in this time. The church and the faith in it and the God it represented was deeply ingrained into the very fabric of the early Tudor world. In all aspects of life, the church had a greater power even than Henry VII, for while he had sovereignty, the church had magisteria. What is magisteria? It's a word that means teaching authority. The church was the final word on a lot of things. And while today we can accept the magisteria of a church would be on things like, you know, church doctrine and theology, and maybe if we wanted issues like sin and morality, the magisteria of the Tudor church was much larger. They were the final authority on subjects as diverse as economics, architecture, law, science, war, art, politics, fashion, diet, agriculture, medicine, animal husbandry, navigation, philosophy, sexual habits, pharmacology, history, and more. And away from the ranks of archbishops and bishops and priests, the myriad of lower-ranked clerics, the clerks, the deacons and deans and prebenders, the church's impact on daily life and its impact upon how people conceptualize the world around them is incredible and alien to us. I mean, Tudor law we know was one based on public shame, and we see that with the stocks at Cheapside or the way harlots are made to walk in just shifts carrying candles. This was spawned from the church belief of contrition, which saw penance begin with public humiliation and was a powerful weapon used by the church at every opportunity. You see them countering belief in magic by claiming magic for themselves. The Tudor church maintained the medieval church's tradition that the working of miracles was proof that magic was real, provided it was channeled via the realm of faith. And as we covered back in detail in the Ephemeris of London back in chapter 58, the church in the reign of Henry VII still maintained, and for the same reasons, the glorious legions of saints to act as figures to venerate and to be in awe of. The stories of the saints related the miraculous achievements of holy men and women and stressed how they could, well, isn't it interesting, they could prophesize the future, which would be a really good power for people living in the 1490s, so prone to external forces. Saints could control the weather, again, dealing with the overwhelming fear of bad harvest. What a great power. They could provide protection against fire and flood. Again, a deep concern for everybody's mind right now, as we just covered. And they could bring relief to the sick. Saints, it seemed, specialised in dealing with the myriad issues that people at this time had. That was bloody useful. Many of the stories of saints were retold in something called the Golden Legend, a popular compilation by a 13th century Archbishop of Genoa, which was translated by Caxton in 1483 and reissued in England in this decade and at least seven times over the next few decades. Paradoxically, it must be repeated that the mainstay of those who performed miracles were often not priests or bishops. These wild magical effects were more often caused by members of the laity. As we see in the way the church in those early Tudor era did not, as an institution, claimed the power to work miracles. They just got the prestige of the doings of those who God deemed to have been given magical powers. They built upon the love of saints. Shrines were popular. Pilgrimages were encouraged in places like Glastonbury, Lindisfarne, Walsingham, St Albans, Canterbury and Westminster had become places to which the sick and infirm made long and weary journeys in their confident expectation of attaining a supernatural cure. While the era of the great ecstatic miracle factory of St. Bart in North London, which we covered back in chapter 60, had long passed, London had its own saint who even now is seen as being a force upon the city. There were over 500 miracles associated with St. Thomas à Becket and his shrine. I mean, the belief in the magic of churches was seen on the very walls themselves. Churches were vibrant, colourful places inside, adorned from ceiling to floor in rich paintings resplendent in colour and detail, and upon which icons of saints were often painted, whose mere sight could bring magical intercession. A representation of St. Christopher, who so frequently adorned the walls of English village churches and the churches of London, was said to offer a day's preservation from illness or death for any who gazed upon it. St. Wilgefort, better known as St. Uncumber, had a statue stood in St. Paul's Cathedral, and it was said that husbands could deal with their discontented wives by offering that saint a peck of oats. Saints were believed to have power to bestow diseases as well as relieve them. In the next century, William Tyndall was to write, quote, "We worship saints for fear lest they be displeased and angry with us, or plague us, or hurt us. Who is not afraid of St. Lawrence? Who dare defy St. Anthony a fleece of wood for fear of his terrible fire? Or at least he send the pox amongst our sheep," unquote. The worship of saints was then an integral part of the very fabric of early Tudor London, and sustained by important social considerations. Individual churches had their own patron saints, and strong territorial associations could come with them. As we described last chapter, the grocer's company had been born out of the parish fraternity of St. Atheline, and many of the early livery companies had similar parish origins. One church, their saint, and the community around it. Every trade had the patronage of its own, a special saint, who was usually worshipped by members of those trades on a holy day. At some point in the future, a future Protestant writer would mock the Catholic veneration of trade saints, saying, quote, "Our painters had Luke, our weavers had Stephen, our millers had Arnold, our tailors had Goodman, our cobblers had Crispin, our potters had St. Gore with the devil on his shoulder and a pot in his hand. Was there a better horse leech than St. Louis, or a better sow gelder than St. Anthony, or a better tooth drawer than St. Apolline?" Unquote. But while he's mocking them, it reveals the extent of the saints even in business. Now, we know in the next century the worship and veneration of the myriad saints seems to have diminished considerably, representing a forever break between those who came afterwards and those of this time. But keep in mind, right up until the reign of Henry VIII and all that's to come with it, the miracles at various holy sites continued to be reported. Belief in the ways of the church and its rituals infected all aspects of life, even beyond business. Take church blessings, for example. The basic ritual was a benediction of salt and water for the health of the body and expulsion of evil spirits. But the liturgical books of the time also contained rituals which were there to bless a house, or to bless a cow, or to bless some crops. There were variant rituals existed to call God's blessing upon ships you sailed upon, the tools a craftsman used, the armour soldiers wore into battle, and not forgetting specific blessings for mundane things like a well or a kiln. There were formulas for blessing men who were preparing to set off on a journey, or men to go fight a duel. There were procedures for blessing the sick and for dealing with sterile animals, for driving away thunder and for making a marriage bed fruitful. And such rituals involved the presence of a priest and the employment of holy water and the sign of the cross. Basically, the whole procedure was the idea of exorcism, the formal conjuring of the devil after some material object by the pronunciation of prayers and the invocation of God's name. This fundamental belief in the underlying power of exorcism there is something that must be mentioned. The psychological response of seeing bad things in the world is the work of actions of the devil, or simply a devil, and that the church could bring God's power to mitigate against it and thus produce good things and a favourable result, was ingrained deeply in the mindset of everyone in this era. And while the very ignorant people would see this, and behind it the sheer massive belief in superstition and magic, be it orthodox magic via holy miracles and intercessions by saints, or heterodox magic being performed by head witches like Eleanor Cobham, whose life we covered in chapter 156, and we could look at this and go, oh, how stupid these people were, and get all smug. In truth, looking down on these beliefs only reveals our own ignorance. These beliefs are a byproduct of the world these people live in. They are as self-evidentially truthful to those people as cynically sneering that all religious beliefs are dumb while living in a world where we can make a meal as easily as turning on a microwave is to ours. How we conceptualize the world is built upon the foundations of that very world itself. In the face of such uncertainty in their lives, the people of Tudor London would turn to superstition. And if the church didn't provide a channel for magic, the people would make up their own. And they did. The residents of London at this time were superstitious in a way that we would have real difficulty coping with. We still have a few of them hanging around today. Back then, horses were believed to repel witches and evil spirits, and thus the lucky horseshoe came into being. However, it had to be a horseshoe that a horse had actually cast off naturally and had to be made of iron. The number of 13 was, and still is, thought to be unlucky because 12 was thought to be perfect. 7 years' bad luck off breaking a mirror also stems from the era before. But the people of the Tudor era also believed in putting birth membranes, or cauls, into lockets. These allegedly gave them protection against drowning, which is why sailors liked to get hold of them. The church did try to capture these beliefs and work themselves into the very heart of them. People believed that tolling certain bells would keep thunder and lightning away, that reading the gospel to sick cows would cure them, that reading the gospels to women giving birth would ensure a healthy child. Holy water could be sprinkled on crops to make them grow. And thus we come back to the hardest of paradoxes. How do you grasp how people used to think in the past? As a historian, I find it very hard to explain. This entire episode of the podcast was an attempt, and I'm not sure if it worked. I left out and removed in editing far more than I originally wished to include, not wanting to drown the listener in minutiae. In truth, they were and remained foreigners to us. The Londoners of the 1490s were a people who faced incredibly harsh lives compared to our own. Disease stalked them, illness struck them, misfortune as simple as a flood or fire could destroy all they had worked for. They sought stability over freedom, and they sought social advancement, not so much to give their children better opportunities, but so as to prevent falling down into the massive pit of the desperate poor. Compared to us, they were much more drunken, but yet they also cared more about sin. They took more risks, but they were also much more superstitious. They were paradoxical and hard-working, not out of any later Victorian belief that hard work made you a better person. Please, they would have rightfully judged and sneered that. No, they worked hard. If they did not, they could starve. They were tough and they were desperate, endlessly desperate. They were a people into whose hand the city's future was placed. And acting on these simple energies of desire and motivation changed the nature of our city forever. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. Story of London returns next week with another chapter. But this time we're going to return to the normal history and we're back to Henry VII. Thanks for listening. I'll see you then. Bye.